answer most of them today. So one of the questions was, what did we do with the scalar potential? Because in the expression for the electric field, we should have a phi. So I will just show you that it actually goes to zero as a consequence of the Coulomb gauge. So if we take this expression and put it into the Maxwell's equation. Then you will get an expression and so then picking the Coulomb gauge sets this thing to zero, and then the condition that this is equal to zero means that phi is going to be zero. So then we didn't have it in the expression for the electric field. Does that answer? I guess it was your question.
You just got the Laplace. I mean, it's fine.
I think you can just choose it to be zero, but it's not necessarily zero.
You have additional freedom.
Right.
I mean, this is what we solve to get electrostatics, where phi is the main thing.
That's zero, right?
Sorry?
That equation tells you phi is zero.
Yeah.
Okay. By uniqueness, we can, I guess, say.
Should decay at infinity and
I think that it tells you that phi should be zero, but we can talk about it further in the tutorial if I've had more time to think about it. Yeah. Okay, so that's one question. The other question was about the cutoff frequency. So that is something we don't, in quantum optics, it's not something we worry about in practice. It's something you will, so I talked to Gang, she calls it the black magic of renormalization. So you will touch it, touch on it a little bit in quantum field theory one, and then you will like discuss it extensively in quantum field theory two. So I will leave that for future discussions. Then the other question was whether in the expression for the Hamiltonian, these should be magnitudes. So I actually I interpreted your question to mean is this like is E a complex field? So in that sense, no, because so we can, if this thing is a complex number, then if you subtract its Hermitian conjugate, then you get a imaginary number multiplied by an I will give you a real number. But if these things are vectors, which they are, and you mean this to mean that it's the absolute value of like the vectors, then yeah, you can have those there. So the E fields are real, but if you care about the fact that E is a vector, then you can put your whatever those lines are in there. The absolute values. Okay, and then so there were some questions about the mode functions. So I thought just to make it a little bit clearer, yesterday I was trying to be general and not to go into too many details, but just so it's a bit clearer. So you have something to visualize. So one example of the mode functions is for a cubic volume with sides L. So there we would have the plane wave solutions. So UK would have this e to the I k dot r term, and then it would also have a polarization vector. So then the k is a sum over a bunch of different discrete variables. So one of them is the two polarization variables, and the others are the Cartesian component of the wave vectors, so like that. But we just use the label k as shorthand over to be a sum over all of those variables. Okay, so before I start today's topics, are there any other questions about anything we discussed yesterday? No? Okay. Cool. So, like I said, in this lecture, we're going to be talking about the interaction picture. So, the things that, well, the interaction picture, the rotating wave approximation, and spontaneous emission. So, the interaction picture is going to come in handy when you're doing quantum field theory, because you're going to be explicitly calculating things in the interaction picture. It's also in condensed matter, it'll kind of come in implicitly because you'll be evolving things according to interaction Hamiltonians. Rotating wave approximation, it comes up a lot in quantum optics, and it'll come up again in relativistic quantum information at the end of the year, where we look at what happens when you go beyond quantum optics approximations. So there, Eduardo will discuss beyond the rotating wave approximation. Then spontaneous emission, that'll actually come in handy next week. So we're going to be talking about generalized transformations on systems as a result of coupling to an environment. So we'll in spontaneous emission, we'll see an explicit example of that. And then time ordering, of course, is going to come in handy in all your quantum field theory calculations. Okay, so let's start with the interaction picture. Okay, so in Mater's course, you already saw two different pictures. You saw the Schrodinger picture and the Heisenberg picture. So the Schrodinger picture is nice when you're thinking about how states evolve. I think it's a really nice picture conceptually. And the Heisenberg picture is useful, but maybe when it's like too difficult to calculate the entire state, how that evolves, but maybe it's enough to just calculate the expectation value of some observables that you're interested in. But the picture that we're going to look at here, it's really useful for doing certain interaction calculations. So this is the standard technique for solving problems in quantum optics. And we'll see that you can kind of think about it as being an intermediate picture between Heisenberg and Schrodinger. So in the interaction picture, typically what we do is we take the Hamiltonian and split it up into two different parts. And this choice is, it's completely arbitrary. So different choices of splitting up will yield different interaction pictures. But typically what we do is we choose this to be the free or unperturbed Hamiltonian. So perhaps something that you know how to solve exactly. And then this thing, we choose to be some perturbation. And so in the problems that we're going to be looking at today, this thing is it's an interaction between two different systems. But in quantum field theory, you'll see that this could be a self-interaction term. And in quantum mechanics, we typically try and have this Hamiltonian be's the strength of this Hamiltonian to be small compared to the free Hamiltonian. But you'll see in quantum field theory that that's not always the case as well. Okay, so to see how splitting things up like this is useful, let's first have a look at what happens to the expectation value of some observable in the Schrodinger picture. So this is the expectation value of the operator A And I'm just putting subscript s on here so we can keep track of the fact that we're in the Schrodinger picture. Okay, and then the next step is to, which is actually a trick we use all the time in quantum mechanics, is to insert some resolutions of identity. Where I'm just setting h bar to 1, just so I don't have to rewrite it over and over again. And so if we do that, we can identify. Maybe I should have. Okay, we can identify this thing as being a ket, which we now call the interaction ket. This as being another operator, which we call the interaction picture operator. And then here we have another interaction ket. Typo in my notes. Let me just correct. Yeah. Okay, so we have an expression for the expectation value in terms of these new kets and new operators. And the nice thing is that, do we see that yet? Maybe not. Okay, yeah, so we can see from here that the dynamics of the operator in the interaction picture are just determined by the free Hamiltonian. So that's easier to compute than evolving everything by this full Hamiltonian. But that's not the only nice thing. So we'll be able to find a nice expression for how the state vector in their interaction picture evolves as a function of time as well. So let's do that. Okay. okay, so first, okay, so we have the expression for how the operator evolves in the interaction picture, and now we would like to know how the ket evolves in the interaction picture. So we can write down the thing that we're interested in, which is the time evolution of the interaction picture ket as a function of time. And then we can insert our expression for, maybe I didn't write it down. Oh, I'll write it down here. Maybe it is just, okay. I'm getting confused with my subscripts, which is supposed to be making things easy, not difficult. Okay, so we can insert that expression into here. And get okay, and then because we know that the thing that we're after is an evolution equation, I'm just going to put it at, put in convenient factors of I, and expand this expression. And then if we evaluate this derivative, we get minus h naught e to the I h naught t. Okay, where to get from this line to this line, we just use the Schrödinger equation. Where I have something missing. Okay, so now I'm going to insert the expression for the Hamiltonian into H, so that's H0 plus B, the way that we've split it up in our definition of the interaction picture. And we get the time derivative of the interaction picture ket minus H0. The first term doesn't change, and then the second term. Okay, so I'll let you guys look at it and tell me. Can you see if any of the terms should cancel here?
Zero.
Yep. With that one. And so why is it okay to move the H0 over to the left?
Yeah.
Okay, good. Okay, so then these terms cancel. And we get. And now I do the trick that we always like to do, which is insert a resolution of identity. And then I can use our definitions of the interaction picture gets to write this as so does that equation remind you of any equation? Right, so it looks exactly like the Schrodinger equation, except it's not evolution according to the Hamiltonian that describes the entire system, but it's evolution just according to this interaction Hamiltonian. But the thing that's evolving is now this interaction picture ket. Okay, so there's a couple of reasons why we might want to do this. One of them is that if V is small, then we can use perturbation theory to solve these expressions perturbatively, just according to the interaction Hamiltonian, and just having to deal with the interaction Hamiltonian on its own rather than the full Hamiltonian can make calculations easier. But then another nice thing is that we can use this picture to make some approximations. So I will show examples of both of those two things. So I'll show how we can use the interaction picture perturbatively, and I will show how we can make this rotating wave approximation, which then lets us simplify the system and actually get exact solutions, which is always good. Okay. Oh, and actually, maybe just to try and connect this a bit to what David said. So when we do this rotating wave approximation, we're going to kind of get things that seem to make sense physically, that we have things like emission of a photon from an atom, and then maybe we can go the other way around. A photon leaving the electromagnetic field would excite an atom, and then an atom will, if you think of an atom as a detector, it's going to be able to see photons that are inside, existing in the electromagnetic field. And so I know David mentioned last week something called the Unruh effect. And so that's an effect where if you have a detector, so a two-level atom that's acting like a detector, and if it's just going through the vacuum, it's not going to see any photons and it's not going to click. But if you accelerate this detector, then even if it's going through a vacuum where there are no photons, it's actually going to start clicking as if it's seeing photons. This is something called the Unruh effect, and this is something you would not be able to predict if you make this rotating wave approximation that we're going to make. But in the relativistic quantum information course, Eduardo is going to be talking about beyond the rotating wave approximation. And there you will see things that seem like they're violating energy conservation because your photons are getting absorbed by the atom even though they're not leaving the field. But we'll see that it's actually not violating energy conservation because the whole system satisfies energy conservation. Okay, but here we will just look at the simple case where we have, where we do this approximation. Okay, so say example, three-level atom. Okay, so the atom is going to have two states, the ground and the excited state. And there's going to be an energy difference between these two states. So we can write down the Hamiltonian for the atom as h bar omega a sigma z on 2. Where sigma z is the Pauli operator. Which we can write in the basis of the two-level atom. And we're going to, so recall yesterday when I wrote down the Hamiltonian, it was a sum over all of the modes. So it was a set of uncoupled harmonic oscillators. But here we're only going to consider a cavity. So we can just pick out one of those modes. And we're going to just consider one of them to make the calculation more simple. Okay, so I will just write down the Hamiltonian of the field is going to be just h bar omega c a dagger a, where I'm ignoring the vacuum contribution, which would normally give you a plus half plus omega c on 2. So here omega c is the resonance frequency of the cavity. Okay, and then we have an interaction. Between the field and the atom. Okay, so here we've got coupling between the electric field and the atom, the spin component of the atom. And I'm just going to approximate. I'm going to not worry about the coefficients in front of the electric field. And I'm writing the spin operator in terms of the raising and lowering operators for the atom. So this plus takes the ground state to the excited state, and the minus the excited state to the ground state. Okay, so this Hamiltonian as a whole is not exactly solvable. So we're going to use the interaction picture to try and make some progress. Okay, so let's write the whole Hamiltonian for the entire system. And so I said at the beginning that we're kind of free to split up the the Hamiltonian in any way that we like, but there's, you know, some ways that are more reasonable than others. So for this particular Hamiltonian, what do you think would be a convenient way to break up into the free bit and the perturbation bit? Yes?
I have a question.
Yeah, sure.
Why do you model the Hamiltonian of the field as a harmonic oscillator?
Why?
Like we can write it as A dagger, A H bar.
So yesterday we showed that the electromagnetic field, the Hamiltonian for that. Actually, we can see it here. Yeah. So maybe I should have done a recap. But so we had this expression, and we had the B, and we inserted those into here, and we got H equals.
Can we suppress the energy of vacuum?
Yeah, so there should be some coefficients out the front, and I'm just I'm saying it's proportional to, because I don't want to be writing them, and they don't really change the physics. It'll be just change the strength of the perturbation. Okay, yeah. So we want to split up this Hamiltonian. What's a convenient way to do it?
This interaction alone, because the action part.
The one that says interaction alone? Yeah. Okay, so you're saying split it up. Part of it is going to be like this, and part of it is going to be like that? Who agrees with that? Who disagrees with that? You disagree, or you have a question?
We should split the Hamiltonian in a way that we know the eigenvalues and eigenvectors in the ground state, right? When in the H0.
Yeah, so it would be nice if we could solve the free part exactly.
But ground and excited states are eigenvalues or of the atom Hamiltonian, but not of the field Hamiltonian.
Uh-huh. So, because these are in different Hilbert spaces, then the ground states of the entire Hamiltonian are going to be tensor products of the ground states of this Hamiltonian and the ground states of this Hamiltonian.
Oh, okay. Yeah, so we're not summing them.
Well, so this is the way people write it, but really what it should be is a direct product atom. It should be like that, but like no one.
It's a product, no. It's a product, right?
When you add the Hamiltonians, I think you do a
tensor product.
Oh, plus no, you. I don't think for the Hamiltonians it is. Is it? Or maybe that's just the definition of the. Okay, sorry. Maybe I'm getting things. Adam. That is. Yeah. Good. I'm glad I have you guys. Otherwise, I'd be talking to an empty room, which would be weird. Yes? Yeah. I don't know, is it just... Yeah, I mean, I can totally do it, but I'm worried because, like, no one's ever said this before, and now, like, everyone's saying it, so I don't know if just this whole time no one's been able to read what I'm doing. Or is it just... You guys use your phones too much and you can't see? I don't know. Okay, so yes, I will write bigger. Before I start writing bigger, should I rewrite anything? I guess this is pretty small, but do you want me to rewrite this?
The rest is fine.
Okay. So. Okay. So H equals. Let's be explicit. So then, okay, most people thought that we should split up this as one of the parts and this should be the other part. And just to make sure you're listening, which is which?
Interaction is between
the two. Yes?
Interaction is the V part.
Yes, very good. Thank you for indulging me. No! Okay, good. Okay, so what we want to do is now actually convert those Hamiltonians into the interaction picture. And I think we can get away with just converting the interaction Hamiltonian. Because, yeah. Okay, I'm now putting the H bars back in. Okay, so I'm going to get you to help me out here. So we expect the interaction Hamiltonian to have the same four terms, but it's now going to have some phases that come from acting this bit. On the V. So maybe we can just start with the first term. Minus omega C. Yeah. So you got that from acting this on the annihilation operator. Yeah. Okay. And does anything happen to this guy?
H bar omega A minus H bar omega A.
H bar omega A minus. Okay, let's maybe do it.
Sigma plus. Oh no, it stays the same, but with a minus.
I think. Okay, maybe I'm gonna change the energies just so that it's easier. Okay, let's do it. I'm just gonna shift everything by half of the frequency. Okay, this should make it easier. If I assume that the ground state energy is zero, so I've shifted everything, and then the energy of the excited state compared to that is now h bar omega a. I realized I was like pulling a phase out implicitly, so but maybe that'll make it easier. Yes, excellent. Excellent, yeah. So how can we see that? Well, I think it's good for you guys to do it yourselves. But yeah, you get exactly that. You get omega A T. Okay, and we can go through the same process for all of the terms and get, so I get the phases right. So that is the interaction picture, Hamiltonian. So we could do two things with it. The first thing that we're going to do is just use it to evolve the state perturbatively. And then the second way that we're going to use it is to do this rotating wave approximation. Now, you might be thinking, why did I do this? Or maybe, I mean, maybe you're still thinking, why would I want to make my Hamiltonian look more complicated? But the reason is now that I can just evolve everything according to that Hamiltonian, while before, if I kept it in the Schrodinger picture, I would have to evolve the whole thing according to three Hamiltonians. And having an e to the I plus three Hamiltonians would just be annoying to keep track of. OK, so. For simplicity, we're going to just consider the case where the atom is on resonance. So what I mean by that is the two frequencies are the same. So I can now simplify this. I'm going to is yes.
Is this like is that interaction Hamiltonian supposed to be Hermitian?
Yes.
If you take a Hermitian conjugate of the first term, wouldn't you expect that last term to have like the equal but opposite
tensor product still, so you can.
Does that help?
Yeah, that's what I expected.
Okay, thank you. Which I had right here, so. Okay, and now we're going to just assume that our initial state is that our atom is in the excited state and there are no photons inside the cavity. So now we want to evolve the state as a function of time. And we know that all we have to do is evolve according to this interaction Hamiltonian in the interaction picture. And we're going to assume that we only care what's happening for just a little bit of time and that the coupling is pretty weak. So we're going to do a first order expansion of this unitary operator. Now I'm going to insert this expression into here. And so at this point, we might be really dreading the fact that we have to do some integrals, but it turns out that all of the integration terms disappear. So let's go through it in detail. Okay, so one acting on that initial state will just give us the initial state. So we have no photons in the cavity and an excited atom. And then let's see what happens. Well, if we act the lowering operator on, well, let's not go there yet. Okay, if we act the annihilation operator on the vacuum state, that's just going to go to zero. So that's great. If we act the raising operator on the excited state, that's going to go to zero as well. Again, if we act the annihilation operator on the vacuum, that goes to zero. And then the only term that gives us a non-zero contribution is a term that creates a photon from the vacuum and a term that takes the excited state to the ground state of the atom. Okay, so what's going on here? So we start off with a atom prepared in the excited state. There are no photons around. And then if we just let it evolve, we see that with some probability, the photon's going to be emitted from the atom and into the cavity. And we haven't talked about entanglement yet, but I'll tell you in advance that what's happening here is that the state of the atom is now becoming entangled with the state of the cavity, because we can't write this as a tensor product of the state of just the atom and the state of the cavity. So that's something we will talk about later on Wednesday and Thursday.
How did the first term go to zero? Because it's sigma minus and acting on the excited state should be
A acting on. Yeah, A acting on the vacuum.
Where do we get our G though?
Yeah.
It's here, except at some stage it was a capital omega.
Uh-huh, okay, we just didn't write it. Okay.
Where did I? At some stage I changed this as well. Yeah, okay. Yeah. So that's the case. So we did this perturbatively. That's what we see at short times. But what happens at longer times? Well, we could just expand it to higher and higher orders, but we don't want to do that. So what we can do is to now make this rotating wave approximation. So we'll step back a bit and make the rotating wave approximation to make this whole system solvable exactly. And then we can see what happens at all times. So because it's an approximation, we know that it's not going to work in all regimes, but it's going to be valid in some regimes. And the regime that this approximation is valid in is when the two energies, so the energy difference of the atom and the energy of the cavity, are really close together compared with their individual energies. So if we do that, then this is going to be small. And this is going to be large. And so let's take a look at, where is our Hamiltonian? OK, so just above the 1.2, we have the Hamiltonian that has both the omega c's and the omega a's. And so you can see that the terms with either the I omega c plus omega a, they're going to be really quickly oscillating because omega A plus omega C is large. And so the approximation is that those terms are going to average out to zero and we can just drop them. And so the thing that we're then left with is, so quickly oscillating terms. Go to zero and then we just get the terms that depend on the frequency differences. So, and then in order to just look at a simpler case for the example that I'm going to do on the board, we're going to assume that the atom is now exactly on resonance with the cavity, and we can just assume there's one frequency that we're dealing with. Okay, so in that case, our interaction Hamiltonian simplifies even more. Into terms that just, it looks like these are the energy conserving terms because they pull a photon out of the atom and put it into the cavity, or pull a photon out of the cavity and put it into the atom. But in fact, even the terms that look like they're not energy conserving, they're not actually not energy conserving. And we'll discuss that in later courses. But okay, so we have this Hamiltonian, and then I'm going to just write it out in the eigenbasis of the free Hamiltonian. So we have a sum over n, which is over the photons, over the Fock states. So it looks like this. And you can see now explicitly the thing that I was talking about, that it's right? Doesn't look good. Yeah, it's pulling a photon out of the field. So n plus one goes to n, and it's taking the ground state to an excited state. So it's putting the photon into the atom. Okay, so the next step is, if we know how to, if we know that this can be solved exactly, the next thing we want to do is to just diagonalize that Hamiltonian. So if we go through that process, diagonalize. Okay, and the easiest way to check that that's actually the case is to just take those expressions and plug them into here, and then you'll see that a bunch of the cross terms disappear, and the thing that you end up with, well, a bunch of the diagonal terms disappear, and you end up with the cross terms here. Okay. Okay, so we've diagonalized the Hamiltonian. So now what we want to do is, again, go through the process of where we apply the evolution operator on the initial state. So we have the same initial state. It's going to be the field in the vacuum state and the atom in the excited state. But it's much easier doing calculations in the eigenbasis of the Hamiltonian that you're evolving it to. So what we want to do is to just rewrite this ground state in the eigenbasis of that Hamiltonian. So we can write that as and again, you can check that that's the case just by plugging in those states in there and seeing how the bits that cancel. Okay, so then finally, let's now solve, see how the state evolves. So the thing that's nice about being in the diagonal basis is that when we exponentiate this, we just have to exponentiate the coefficients in front of the diagonal terms. And then it's just easy, like matrix multiplication. And we find that we get in terms of this diagonal basis, something that looks like this. And then just so we can compare it with our previous result, I'd like to rewrite that in the eigenbasis of the free Hamiltonian, and we get cosine of g of t 1/2 times the initial state minus I sine g t 1/2 plus the other term where the photon has been now put into the cavity. So you can see for small t that this is actually a good approximation for what we see here. But for large t, the exact solution looks like that. So you can actually see what happens inside the cavity is that the atom is going to spontaneously decay, and the photon will be emitted into the cavity. But then the photon's going to bounce around in the cavity, and after some time, it's going to be absorbed again by the atom. And so there's going to be this sinusoidal change in the population, in the excited state probability of the atom. So that's just an effect of the cavity. While if you were to solve the more complicated problem of the atom being inside, just being free and interacting with the entire electromagnetic field, then you would see that the atom just decays and then like never gets excited again because the photon just goes off like into space and doesn't get to interact again with the atom. Okay, so that was all I wanted to say about the interaction picture, and I guess in the last 20 minutes, I will move on to talking about the Dyson series. But before I do that, do you guys have any questions about this stuff? Okay. Okay, so yesterday I was talking about this process called parametric downconversion, which is the way in which that many labs around the world make interesting quantum states of light. And so I argued that the state that comes out is going to be something that is a superposition of vacuum state, one pair of photons, two pairs of photons, and so on. And I told you that life is not so simple, because this is just a simple model that assumes that we have single frequencies going in and coming out. But in reality, there's going to be some sort of frequency distribution. There'll be a distribution over different momentum vectors in here, so they will induce correlations between the frequencies. So in order to model the frequencies, we have to look at kind of a more detailed Hamiltonian than the one that led us to that. So let's, before I get to that though, so the full Hamiltonian is going to be a time-dependent Hamiltonian, and it's going to be type of Hamiltonian that does not commute at different times, commute with itself at different times. So I think Mehta already told you that if you have a Hamiltonian that doesn't commute at different times, then the formal solution to the Schrodinger equation for that is going to be a time-ordered evolution operator. So we would have to write that the output state is going to be time ordering operator times e to the minus i on h integral over time of the Hamiltonian. And in this case, we're going to assume that the input that the modes corresponding to the output frequencies are in the vacuum state. So we're going to assume there are no photons to begin with. Okay, and the way that you deal with this time ordering, if you're doing perturbation theory, is to expand it using something called the Dyson series, which looks very much like the Taylor series. The two differences are the coefficients out the front are slightly different, and there's also a series of nested time integrals. So the first two terms look just like the Taylor series. But then the second term, it doesn't have a half. And it has this time time-dependent integration variable. Okay, I'll explain what I mean in a sec. Okay, so in this term here, you have an integration from t0 to some time t prime, but then that t prime is the thing that you're going to be integrating over here. So kind of if we want to look at it in like kind of geometrically, so if we plot the axes that we're integrating over, so how would I want to do this? Okay, so let's make sure we get this right. Okay, so if we're integrating over t double prime, then we're going to go from some point t0 up to where t double prime equals t prime. So we're going to just integrate up to this line. And then here we're going to integrate from t0 to t. So that would be, let's say, from t0 to t. So then the integration region that we're integrating over is just this region here. And so you can see that, or at least that's one motivation for why in the Taylor series, you would have a factor over half here, because in a Taylor series, these this integration does not depend on this parameter. This would be just like a T. And so then you'd be integrating over this full space, and you would then have to divide by half in order for everything to work out right. But since we've got this nested integral, we don't have this factor of a half, and then this T prime depends on that. And so in the example that we're going to look at, we will look at the consequences of that. And I will show you how to deal with actually doing these nested integrals. Okay, so nonlinear optics is really, really hard, and quantum nonlinear optics is like even harder. The books on it are like huge volumes, and so there's like, you know, you would need to do like a whole degree on nonlinear quantum optics to do everything exactly step by step, and even, you know, people doing research in the field don't even aren't even able to treat everything exactly just because it's very, very complicated. So I'm going to motivate where these things come from, and I'm going to motivate a bunch of approximations we're going to make in order to get this to a point where it's solvable. And then you'll see it's still really like hard to solve. But it'll probably leave you a little bit unsatisfied not being able to see all of the steps. But unfortunately, in 15 minutes, it's like not possible to cover everything. Okay, so the interaction. Oh, and even like where we're starting is already like a huge approximation, because of course in here we have like loads and loads and loads of atoms. So before we looked at how to solve the interaction of one field mode and one atom, but here we're going to have all of the field modes interacting with like, you know, a gazillion atoms. So even treating that problem is difficult. And so people write down effective Hamiltonians, which are just interactions between the three fields mediated by this nonlinear medium. And so the effective Hamiltonian is a product of these three fields, where the fields are these field operators. Yeah, those fields are these operators here. And there's an implied Einstein summation convention, and then this thing here is called the electric susceptibility, and that determines how strong the interaction is between each of the fields, and so that strength is going to depend on the different Cartesian components, which are these I, J's, and K's. So that's already like too hard to deal with, so we're going to make a whole bunch of approximations to get it to something that's solvable. Okay, so I will just list these down. Okay, one of them is that we're going to assume that the pump field is classical. So we're going to just describe it by a complex field rather than operator. We're going to assume that the interaction is happening inside a waveguide. So a waveguide is a region of the material that has a different refractive index, and it kind of contains the light. And so if you have like a very, very narrow one-dimensional waveguide, you can just assume that you have a single wave vector going in that direction. And you don't have to deal with three-dimensional space. And if we just assume that everything's happening in one direction, then we only have to consider the k-vector in that direction rather than that direction. So rather than having now a bunch of k's, we just deal with the frequencies that correspond to the one-dimensional field traveling in some direction. So assume 1D waveguide. I'm going to assume that there's something called phase matching, which is conservation of momentum inside the material. So you can see that this expression here, it's a product of terms that each thing has two components. So if we expanded that out, we would have eight terms, and that's a lot of terms to deal with. But in practice, a lot of those terms will go to zero, because if you're working at six specific frequencies and a specific material, then you won't have momentum conservation for a bunch of those terms. So we will assume that we're working in a regime where only two of those terms survive due to momentum conservation, but the other terms go to zero. And so I always say that it's easier to work with discrete variables than continuous ones. But after we've made all of these approximations, it actually gets easier to deal with continuous variables, because everything's just going to be a continuous Fourier transform, which then we can do analytically. So I will take the continuum limit. Oops. Okay, so like after all of those approximations, the simplified Hamiltonian is still horrible. So let's just kind of unpack everything that's going on here. So A is a constant that just captures everything, and it won't add to the physics, so I won't write it down, but it captures things like these coefficients out here in front of the Hamiltonian, and also the coefficients out the front of the expressions for the electric field. And I've made an approximation that the bandwidth of the pump is sufficiently narrow that this, I can just treat it as constant, so I can pull it out the front of the integrals. So there's a whole bunch of constants out here. We have this integral over z. It came from this integral over all space, but remember everything is 1D now. This thing is the spectral distribution of the pump field because we assume that the pump is classical. And then we have integrals over all of the frequencies, and we have creation operators that act on the vacuum. And also we'll have a pair of annihilation operators in the Hermitian conjugate. And these operators depend on frequency. And the frequency distribution is going to be given by like all this stuff that's going on there. Okay, but we can kind of simplify this and use our intuition as a guide. We're expecting it to kind of look something like this. So we can treat it term by term. And we're going to expect that the first order term will look something like a pair of photons. So let's just first look at the first order term. Which from the Dyson series expansion up there is going to be I on H and integral of the Hamiltonian acting on the vacuum state. And I've made another approximation here where we're extending the limits of integration to minus infinity and plus infinity. And we can get away with that because the interaction is only going on inside the crystal. So if we extend it time to minus infinity and plus infinity, it'll just ignore anything where there's no interaction. Yes?
I have two questions.
Yeah.
The first question is, I don't really understand the motivation for the original Hamiltonian.
You need to like read a whole textbook on nonlinear optics, but let's see if I can give a good motivation. Sorry. So you don't think it's dimensionally correct?
No, I don't.
That's not good.
Where's
the dimensionless? So pi is dimensionless. Yeah. Okay, we'd have to. Yeah, maybe it's the Hamiltonian. No, it wouldn't be the Hamiltonian density. Anyway, okay, so let's not worry about the. We only have like a few minutes. Let's not worry about the dimensions, and we can like go through them in the Hamiltonian. But I can give you the physical motivation, which is, so it's an interaction between three fields. So there are three fields. It's the infield and the two outfields. The other way that you can see it is it's kind of like a dipole interaction with an atom. So there we had something that was like the field times the spin vector. So in nonlinear optics, the Hamiltonian is something like the electric field times the polarizability, where the polarizability is like some sort of effective, like giant atom that's the actual electric, that's the induced polarization inside the material. And then you can do a perturbative expansion of this. And it turns out that this, the expansion of this thing is going to be something like an electric field times like twice the electric field and three times that. And so then the one field component here times the two field components there from the second order expansion of the nonlinear polarization kind of gives you those two other fields.
Okay, so this probably answers my next question then. So is the when you're expanding now with the Dyson series, is the expansion parameter the susceptibility?
Exactly, yeah.
Maybe this is a stupid question, but why do we know it's small?
Experimentally, it's very, very small. So compared to, compared to the linear interaction, it's very, very small. But we don't care about the linear interaction here due to phase matching. Like we'd be working in a different regime where it's different energy and momentum conservation than what we get from, that's not even the right way of saying it. We're working at different frequencies. So so the linear term will just get you the pump field coming out the other side, but you can just ignore that and only focus at frequencies that correspond to the down-converted frequencies. And those are going to be like way off from the input frequency. They'll be like half the frequency. So that's a very hand-wavy motivation. In principle, all of these things are happening. So you'll also have these third order interactions happening, but they're also really, really weak. And they'll be happening at different frequencies to the ones here. So if you've got your experiment designed in such a way that you're only looking at frequencies here, it's okay to just treat that. I'm gonna really quickly go through this now. But remind me in the tutorial to come back and address this issue of the constants, the dimensions. Where were we? So if we go through this, because we expect to be getting something like a two photon term, then we can kind of look at what are the components corresponding to the two photon term, and it's going to be this B dagger and A dagger. And we can write things nicely just in terms of those and put all of the unnecessary stuff into a function that's just going to depend on omega B and omega A.
Great.
Yes.
In the simplified Hamiltonian line, I think there's something wrong with the parentheses A and B. What's with the state at the end?
So this parenthesis is for this. This parenthesis is for this. And everything is not acting on a state. Very good. I was preempting myself.
Still, there is one more closed parentheses than open.
One, two, three.
Sorry, I just want to figure out.
Yeah, for sure. That okay then?
So this is just, we take the Hermitian conjugate of the entire three parentheses and add them to the.
Exactly.
Okay.
Yep.
Thank you.
No, it's fine. We're just going to be acting the Hamiltonian now on the input state. So the thing that's the Hermitian conjugate is going to go to zero because we'll just have annihilation operators on the vacuum. So we'll essentially have this acting on the vacuum state. And so it'll look something like integral over A, omega A, integral over omega B. where f of omega a omega b Yes.
Isn't the one that creates a state with, yeah, that one.
Good, thanks. So let's talk through this. Okay, so what we can see is that the first order term is going to be creating two photons, but the photons are going to be described by what's known as a joint spectral amplitude. So it's the frequency distribution of the two photons, but it's a joint function. And in general, it can be correlated. And it's going to have a shape that's going to depend on a few things. So one of the things it'll depend on is the spectral distribution of the input pump field. Another thing it's going to depend on is the phase matching conditions. So these things here depend on the refractive index properties of the material and the nonlinear refractive index properties. So it'll essentially depend on the nonlinear properties of the material. And maybe we can make a few simplifications. So one of them is that this integral here will give us a nice delta function over all of the frequencies. So you can see that's where the energy conservation comes from between the incoming pump fields and the outgoing pump fields. This is an integral you can do analytically. It's called a sinc function. Where sinc x is sine x on x. And so typically, these functions look something like this. If we draw it as a function of the two frequencies, you would have an energy-conserving component that goes along the anti-diagonal, and it could have maybe some sort of like Gaussian distribution, if that's the distribution of the incoming pump field. Then there'll be some other component which can go at some angle, and it'll have the cross-section, that's the sine x on x term. And so in the end, maybe it'll be something, sorry, that kind of looks like this. And so again, we haven't talked about entanglement yet, but what we see here is that there's entanglement in the frequency degree of freedom between the two photons that are coming in, coming out. So that entanglement might be useful, but it also might be detrimental because it can lead to unwanted mixing, which is something that we're going to talk about in next week as well. So the point of this, all of this, was to get to the Dyson series bit, but I definitely don't want to go over time anymore at all. So I will finish that bit at the beginning of the tutorial. But just to outline what would happen is that the thing that will come out is going to be a term that has four photon components, and there's going to be now a four-way a function of four variables that's going to be describing the joint frequencies of the photons coming in. And you get different results, at least at first. It seems like you get different results from doing the time-ordered case versus the naive Taylor series expansion. But then we can see that we can actually get it to collapse back to what you would expect from the Taylor series. And then it's only at the 6-photon term that you start to see deviations according to the time ordering that comes in here. But the main trick that I was going to show you is how to actually go about solving these nested time integrals. We do some like cute change of variables and decouple them. And so we can do that at the beginning of the tutorial. But I'll let you guys go to lunch now.